Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the Liberal Party in New South Wales with John Ruddock, who makes a first-time appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. As normal, he will speak for about 30 minutes. We'll take 30 minutes of questions and discussion and finish just on the top of the hour. John Ruddock has been a Liberal Party member for about 20 years. He contested the presidency of the New South Wales Liberal Party in 2011 and 2012. He was also a staffer for 3 years for Mr. Ross Cameron. And in a professional sense, he's a mortgage broker working out of North Sydney for about 12 years. And tonight, John Ruddock is going to talk for the Sydney Institute on the topic of liberalising the New South Wales Liberal Party. John Ruddock, you're very welcome. Thank you. Front of the camera. Okay. Right, here we go.
Okay, well, thank you, Jared and Anne, for this opportunity. My father told me as a teenager that I should read Jared Henderson whenever I get the opportunity, so it's a great honour to address the Sydney Institute. On the 25th of September, I spoke on the ABC's 7:30 program for 10 seconds. I spoke about the internal affairs of the New South Wales Liberal Party, but I spoke without the authorisation of the state director. I now face suspension of my party membership for 5 years. If just 10 seconds warrants 5 years, then after an hour at the Institute, I fear my suspension may be extended to the year 3813 AD. The New South Wales Liberals are the only party in Australia that routinely suspends members for speaking out about internal affairs. Now, I believe in playing by the rules, but some principles override that consideration. Free speech is one of them. Martin Luther King said, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. Now, the Liberal Party champions free speech, so we have a duty to honour that principle internally. Free speech is sometimes uncomfortable, but it is essential in a free society because it spurs improvement. But the restriction on free speech is just one symptom of the rigid factionalism that has racked the New South Wales Liberals since the 1970s. Robert Menzies would be appalled that a state division of his party has been swamped by trade union mentality that is so alien to our core belief in an individual conscience. Now, I want to put to you two indisputable facts. Firstly, the Liberal Party and its forebears have governed Australia since Federation for over 70% of the time. And secondly, New South Wales is not just one of six states. We have almost one-third of the members of the House of Representatives. And those two realities tell us this. The internal culture of the New South Wales Liberal Party is of national significance. Tonight, I outline a new party structure and a pathway for comprehensive democratic reform to be adopted by the New South Wales Liberals by mid-next year. We will transform our party so that people are enthusiastic about membership. The era of excessive factional division will soon end. Now, I recognise that division within a political party is good when it's about ideas. We are about solving contentious issues. It's expected that the Liberal Party will have a conservative and a moderate wing. Indeed, that maintains our appeal as a broad-based party that wins elections. But in New South Wales, our so-called left and right factions have little to no basis in philosophy. It's a relentless, low-intelligence battle to win control of delegates through payback, coercion, character assassination, rorts, and where factional loyalty trumps merit. The end goal of any party organisation is to put the wisest people available into the position of writing laws. A democratised party will pave the way for better lawmakers. Now, we already have some parliamentary stars. We just want a full team of them. In the past 20 years, I have seen quality individuals express interest in Parliament, but they walk away when told, well, you've got zero hope. You need to pay your dues to a faction for a few years first. Now, some may say, we don't need reform. Everything's fine. Liberals have got a big majority in Macquarie Street and in Canberra. But that logic only holds if our benchmark is the ALP. The recent democratic reforms within Labor were somewhat misguided, though on balance that process was encouraging. But despite that, the internal processes of the ALP remain archaic. Senator Carr recently retired. Do you know who chose the next New South Wales Senator? The Administrative Committee of the New South Wales ALP did. That Administrative Committee of the ALP consists of about 40 people. And do you know how to become a member of the Administrative Committee? Are they elected by the membership? No. Are they even elected by delegates who are elected by the membership? No. Sorry again. The members of the Administrative Committee of the ALP are appointed by unions and Sussex Street. But who appoints the office bearers at Sussex Street? The Administrative Committee does. It's a small group of mates appointing mates. But just quickly on Labor, I do want to praise Senator John Faulkner, who has shown courage and leadership in championing democratic reform. No thoughtful person can deny the contribution of Labor to Australia's success, and so it is in the nation's interests that Labor too properly democratise. So today I'm going to outline a structure which will transform the New South Wales Liberal Party into the benchmark of political excellence in Australia. This structure will, I hope, be a model not just for other Liberal state divisions, but also the ALP. The internal mechanics of the New South Wales Liberal Party have not changed significantly since the 1940s. We are overdue for an upgrade, and a cosmetic makeover won't solve our troubles. We need an entirely new party constitution. The constitution will be democratic, simplified, and welcoming of new members. And yes, it will be open to the media. Every political party has a constitution or a rule book. Other state Liberal divisions have a constitution of about 70 pages, and that's comparable to other political parties around the world. The constitution of the New South Wales Liberals is a staggering 234 pages. It must be a contender for an inglorious world record. Since the 1940s, the party has been structured around branches and delegates. An individual joins their suburban branch, and then the branch elects delegates to pre-selections and to other forums. Few members exercise influence other than voting for delegates. But for the first few decades, this was okay because the branches generally voted for their delegates on merit. Organised statewide factions first appeared in the late 1960s. A right-wing faction saw that it could accumulate power by branch stacking. This simply meant that that faction would recruit new members to specific branches and then instruct them to vote for a branch delegates as a bloc. Stacked branches became phantom branches that barely raised money, recruited candidates, or contributed to campaigns. They simply met once a year with 10 or so people to elect zombie delegates. In the 1980s, a left-wing faction emerged to counter the right. And by the 1990s, around one-third of the party identified with the left, one-third with the right, and the remainder voted on merit. In 1994, we had an important but contentious debate about our pre-selection rules. Previously, a pre-selection panel would consist of just 70 voters. Only a quarter of those voters were delegates from the local branches, and they generally voted on merit. But the clear majority were appointed by head office and usually obeyed a faction. A motion was proposed that would increase the number of locals so that they were the majority on our pre-selections. This was in 1994. The then Shadow IR Minister, John Howard, spoke in support of that motion, and he said, "I support all local members having a say in our pre-selections, as it will curb the power of factions." If we can't go that far today, then this motion is a step in that direction. Members of today's ruling faction argued forcefully against this partial move to democratic reform, but thankfully Mr Howard narrowly won, and not coincidentally, the next pre-selection was Warringah that had this new system that had the locals voting more than the head office people, and that's where Tony Abbott won an unexpected victory, as the merit voting locals had a majority of the say. But since 1994, sadly, most branches have also become factionalised. Today there are around 350 branches in this state. Most are little more than paper branches. Most meetings are dull, poorly attended, and increasingly spiteful. Now, it's not anyone in particular's fault, it's the Constitution's fault. It's a document that has been endlessly tinkered. It's a maze of legalese that few understand, but let me boil down its essence. To become a party member, you need to sign an application form and pay a $95 fee. We once had 40,000 members in this state. Today there are around 10,000. But of those 10,000, only 600 or so enjoy any real influence. Now, I'm sorry, but when only 6% get a vote, it's a similar ratio to the old South Africa. Those 6% are the members of State Council. State Council is made up of one delegate from each branch, regardless of its size, plus our parliamentarians and a few others. Those 600 members of State Council elect our 23-member Board of Directors, or what we call the State Executive. The rules are such that if a faction gets 60% of State Council votes, they will secure 75% control of the State Executive. And when one faction controls 75% of State Executive, they can exercise what's called special powers, which means they can rule by absolute decree and utterly ignore the Constitution. Special powers were introduced for emergencies, such as replacing a candidate during a campaign due to illness. But for the past 2 years, a faction opposed to democratisation has had the 75% of State Executive. And with that power, they have appointed candidates to winnable seats, bypassing our normal pre-selection rules. They've suspended members, they've disbanded branches, and they gerrymander votes. Their guiding principle has been to look after themselves and their mates. So just with a committed 4% of the 10,000 members obeying a certain faction, that faction gets to rule the mighty New South Wales Liberal Party by decree. Now, I'm confident that 80% of party members are in general agreement with democratic reform, but special powers have resulted in our party being hijacked. Now, when a ballot concluded last year, which resulted in that 75% majority continuing on State Executive, a certain Federal MP quoted Julius Caesar on Facebook within 2 minutes of that result being announced. And he said, "War gives the right of the conquerors to impose any conditions they please upon the vanquished." Now, ladies and gentlemen, this structure and this mentality is unacceptable any longer in the party of men. So let's get down to brass tacks. The end goal of all factional activity is the power to select our candidates for Parliament. That process needs reform, but this is how it currently works. Let's imagine a blue ribbon seat, and we'll call it the federal seat of Howard. And let's say its Liberal member has retired. Under current party rules, we would have a pre-selection to choose our candidate. Around 120 party members would be pre-selectors. It doesn't matter if there are 700 members of the party who live in that seat, only 70 will be chosen as delegates for the pre-selectors. The remaining 50 pre-selectors will be selected by the head office. Now, with very few exceptions, when people walk into that pre-selection room, there's 120 people, almost everybody knows how they're going to vote. And with so few voting, a predetermined outcome is easy to pick. 20 years ago, a Frank Robinson of Linfield had a letter in the Australian newspaper. Now, it was 20 years ago, so please excuse the assumption that only men play golf. I quote, "A member of the Liberal Party today can be likened to a golf enthusiast who joins a golf club with the not unreasonable expectation of playing golf. After paying a joining fee, he then discovers that only the officials can play golf. He's expected to mow the fairways, look after the greens, contribute additional money for the upkeep of the club, but not play golf. The very reason he joined. This is the same position of Liberal Party members who pay their fees, are expected to raise funds, help at election time, but have no say in the pre-selection of parliamentary representatives in their own electorate. Why be a member? End quote, and well said, Mr. Robinson, whoever you are. So the first reform is obvious. We need to give every party member a vote in choosing our candidate for the seat they live in. Since branches often reject new members, we must include our members at large, who are members of the party but not of any particular branch. This will result in several hundred members voting, and the outcome will be too difficult to manipulate. The simple process I just described is what's known as a plebiscite. And if the public know that they can have a say in who their local MP is, this will encourage them to join the party. A merit-based selection will also attract high-calibre candidates. Plebiscites were recommended 30 years ago, 1983, in the Vowder report, when John Vowder was the federal president of the party, and it was just after we had lost government with Malcolm Fraser. Most state divisions have since introduced plebiscites, and it has largely ended factional bitterness. The Victorian division used to have four staff members whose job it was purely to look after internal disputes. They introduced plebiscites a few years ago, and now they have one staff member doing only half their time looking after internal disputes. I would hate to think what it is in our head office. I'm sure it's more than four. What the introduction of plebiscites in other states has not resulted in either conservatives or moderates dominating the outcome. It has produced candidates who are in sync with their electorates. Plebiscites have also been embraced in comparable parties all around the world in recent decades, and everywhere it's been regarded as a success. I don't know of any political party that's introduced a form of plebiscite and then said, this isn't working, we're going to reverse it. So I propose each year that all party members who live in a federal seat be invited to attend a one-day annual federal electorate convention. At that convention, the local party executive will be elected by all the members, and if a federal election is due in the next year, that convention would also conduct the plebiscite. These conventions would be vibrant, well-attended meetings, since all local Liberals will vote, not just a few delegates, which is the case at the moment. A similar convention would be held for the state seats. And yes, the media will be invited inside the conventions. A democratised party will not fear our processes being on display. It will be similar to top restaurants, who have an open kitchen for diners to freely observe the preparation process as the chefs are proud of their work. The various conventions across the state will compete to hold the best convention with quality speakers, genuine policy debate, and enjoyable social events. Candidates for a plebiscite will freely engage with the media, but I think they should be prohibited to pay for advertising. Websites will be good, and dare I say, emails will be pretty good too. But paid commercials will favour candidates with deep pockets. Talent will be supreme under a plebiscite, not cash. Now, could the factions still manipulate a plebiscite? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to prevent them even trying. There are two mechanisms which will end the need for organised factions to exist. Now, let's go back to the seat of Howard. Let's imagine in Howard there are 500 sincere party members who live in that seat of Howard. And let's say a candidate for the Howard plebiscite, named Mr. Schema, recruits 1,000 new members who don't care one iota about politics, but they all share with Mr. Schema an ancestry in a village in, say, France. Now, I'm only picking on the French because I've never heard of a French branch stack. Those 1,000 recruits who are one way or another related to Mr. Schemer will all blindly vote for Mr. Schemer, regardless of how thin his resume may be, and that those 1,000 votes would swamp the 500 sincere members. So what are we going to do? Well, we would counter Mr. Schemer by giving the local party executive and the state executive, if they suspect there is an irregularity, the power to invite all party members in the adjoining seats to participate in the plebiscite. The membership will have faith in those executives, as they will be democratically elected executives, unlike our current executives. Most seats share a border with around four others, and a significant number of Liberals will gladly participate. I would estimate that about 30% of people, if they were invited to participate in a plebiscite in the adjoining seat, that they would think, yes, I would like to have a say in who that Liberal member is going to be. Now, if you live in one seat and the neighbouring seat is going to have a plebiscite that you've been invited to participate in, if since you live right next door, you're going to have a fairly good idea of who a suitable candidate for that seat is going to be. Now, as a further backup, and this is a backup that I believe would probably never be used, but by having it there in the first place, it will dispel the power of factions. As a further backup, we will give the local executive and the state executive the power to have a primary instead of a plebiscite. A plebiscite gives a vote to all party members. Now, a primary invites the public to come and have a vote on who our candidates should be. Now, I want to make it clear that I believe plebiscites are better than primaries, as the best people to choose candidates are those with a commitment to the party. But a primary could be a rarely used backup mechanism in case the first countermeasure doesn't work. Now, with these two countermeasures in place, I just don't believe that factions will attempt to manipulate the outcome of a plebiscite. I think if there's a seat and there's five adjoining seats and somebody, a certain candidate is able to get so many people to join the party in all these seats, well, we're probably dealing with an impressive candidate. So then how will we select our candidates for the Senate and for the state upper house? The most factionalised forum in our party is the Senate selection. Around 100 party members presently choose our senators. You know, those senators that go on to represent the 7 million people of New South Wales. Those 100 consist of two delegates from each federal conference, plus our friends on the 22-member state executive. And it's a similar, not identical process, but it's a similar process to the state upper house. In other states of the Liberal Party, Senate candidates are chosen by the several hundred members of state council. Now, that's clearly better. But we will transform the New South Wales Liberal Party into the gold standard political party of Australia. We will give every party member, from Broken Hill to Bondi, a vote in a statewide plebiscite to choose our Senate and our upper house candidates. An annual state convention held at somewhere like the Entertainment Centre or Acer Arena would be the highlight of an individual's membership. The annual state convention would host these contests in the year prior to a state or federal election. Now, this would be an attendance ballot, and for members outside of Sydney, we would have a dozen or so locations across the state where the convention would be broadcast live, allowing all members to watch the candidate speeches and to vote. So sorry, factions, no more postal ballots to rort. A statewide plebiscite for our Senate and upper house candidates will be exciting, dynamic contests. The media would be invited to broadcast the proceedings. Media coverage would inspire people to join our party because people will think, yes, if I become a Liberal Party member, I can have a vote on these important candidate selection processes. And media coverage will also attract high-quality candidates to these contests in the future. Now, the reformers in other states, people like Nick Minchin and Dr. David Kemp, were tempted to democratise the Senate and the upper house selections, but no other state has yet done this. It is, however, I believe, the most critical reform, and let me explain why. Plebiscites for the lower houses will be good in practice, but it won't mean too much in our safe seats. Imagine a party member who lives in Manly, for example. With Tony Abbott and Mike Baird as the local MPs, We can bring in plebiscites, but a party member who lives in Manly probably won't participate in a plebiscite for another 2 decades. But if all party members vote for our Senate and upper house candidates, if you do the mathematics, there's at least a 58% chance in any given year that a member would be given a vote of significance. This reform, more than any other, will grow the membership significantly. It would win back overnight the many thousands of good Liberals who haven't renewed their membership. A large membership will not only defang the factions, it will boost fundraising and volunteering for campaigns significantly. Party members will be enthusiastic about their membership. Now, while talking about the annual state convention, I think it's also very important that our state executive be elected at the annual state convention as well. We need a state executive of the calibre of the board of a publicly listed company. We need to prohibit those with a conflict of interest from serving on the state executive. We need a state executive which acts strictly in the best interest of the party. Now, we will achieve this by giving every party member a vote for our state executive at the annual state convention. Democratic reform has been resisted most forcefully in New South Wales compared to the other states because the ruling faction is dominated by lobbyists. Lobbyists have a positive role to play in a modern economy. Government and business need to communicate efficiently. But one high-profile lobbyist and self-described factional warlord gave an interview shortly after the 2011 state election boasting, "We go from success in the morning to success in the afternoon when we roll out our pre-selections," end quote. Lobbyists in our party have not only been paid to influence lawmakers, in some cases they've been appointing lawmakers. This hasn't happened in any other state. It's a unique feature of the New South Wales Liberal Party, and it explains why reform here is difficult, but we're going to get there. The lobbyists stridently resist democratic reform as it will dilute their political and their commercial power. So many of us have taken a stand and said enough is enough. We will bring about this democratic reform. Those opposed cannot refute our logic, so they hide behind the excuse, "Yes, we need reform, but let's do it after the next election." I've heard that for 20 years. This is a policy of delay. Now, the same thing happened prior to Britain's Great Reform Act in 1832. The Tories controlled the Parliament by denying most people a vote and kept coming up with excuses to delay democratic reform when the people by this stage did want more democracy. Now, the Tories did in the end bow down to public pressure, but it was only after days of rioting and fears of a French-style revolution across England. Now, I'm not advocating riots, but let me be clear. The membership wants democratic reform within months, not years. Yeah. If we delay democratic reform until after the 2015 state election, well, by then we'll be a year out from a federal election and the same excuse will be recycled. Now, last year we did have a vote at State Council to introduce plebiscites. That vote was lost 60% to 40%, but remember, only 5% of the party is voting there. Mm-hmm. We had about 90% of all the people who had turned up as observers, who were people who were members of the party but not entitled to vote, 90% of them were passionately in favour of plebiscites. Now, with few courageous exceptions, the state parliamentary Liberals voted en masse against empowering the membership. And as a result, that is why we today do not have a democratic party. So I want to put the state parliamentary team on notice. Yes, the next state election is important, but a democratised party will help us win the next 20 elections. There will be another opportunity to vote for democratic reform next year. And if the state parliamentary Liberals again block democratic reform, if they continue to think that the membership is just here to hand over money and hand out brochures, then they will sap our motivation for the campaign. A democratised party, on the other hand, in 2014, will have the membership more fired up than ever about winning in 2015. Now, as mentioned, the state executive recently moved to suspend me for 5 years, and that vote was scheduled for this Friday. Now, my superb legal advisor, Professor David Flint, who's here, received notice a few days ago saying that the suspension has been delayed. A crack has appeared in the facade. Now, in the past, suspension for speaking to the media was routine. But this little black duck didn't take the guillotine without a fight. And I want to thank the others who have since spoken to the media in support of democratic reform, risking censure themselves. Michael Bohm, Ross Cameron, David Flint, Joe Francis, Jai Martinkovich, David Miles, Nick Minchin, Michael Ball, and others. To highlight the culture of suspension which hovers over our party members, because I know there are people here who are not members of the party, and you may be surprised to hear this, but just so you know that I'm not making this up, Janet Albrightson recently wrote a story, and this Janet Albrightson has never been a member of the Liberal Party and has never considered joining the Liberal Party. She got a letter threatening her with suspension from the party. I am being targeted because for 2 years I have promoted the ideas that I have outlined tonight. At first the campaign was a little lonely, but a significant turning point was when one of the party's most respected office holders and campaigners, Walter Villatora, who's here, phoned to invite me to lunch. He'd received one of my emails, he'd never heard of John Ruddick before, and he thought I'd better ring this guy up. So we got together and I said to my wife that night, I said, I had a phone call from this guy and he sounds like he could be quite good to the campaign. So we sat down for lunch and he asked me what's going on, and after 5 minutes he reached his hand across the table. He said, John, I am in. I am in all the way. I just test all the factions. Let's liberalise the New South Wales Liberal Party. Yeah. The party membership is now enthusiastically in agreement with these principles. The ruling clique can't refute our arguments and are increasingly behaving erratically. That explains my proposed suspension. But let me be clear. Suspension or no suspension, this campaign will continue. The only acceptable outcome is fundamental democratic reform prior to the next state election. The next step is that Walter and I will soon distribute this speech along with a detailed blueprint for a new constitution. There are details within this framework that need fine-tuning, and we need the valuable feedback of the membership. And we're going to ask for feedback up until Australia Day next year. We are assembling a legal team who will then draft a new constitution. Once we've got that constitution together, we will distribute that draft constitution and we will ask branches and conferences to debate that constitution and to amend that constitution and to let us know their amendments. By mid next year, we will have all those amendments together and we will put together a final version of a new constitution and we will submit that constitution to State Council for ratification. Now, if the State Executive thinks that it can prevent that debate taking place, I remind them of the comprehensive loss they faced in the Supreme Court last year after spending a reported $300,000 trying to stop a similar debate. So let's not try that stunt again, boys and girls. I want to thank the thousands who have encouraged this campaign, but I'm asking you to redouble your efforts. 2014 is the 70th anniversary since Robert Menzies founded the Liberal Party. 2014 will also be the year of democratic reform within the largest branch of Bob's party. We need locals in every electorate to champion reform and to get individuals, branches and conferences to support this process. Don't let factional hotshots intimidate you. The days of coercion are coming to an end. And I appeal to the thousands of sincere Liberals who are former members but who have not renewed your membership. You understand what's at stake. Please renew your membership now. I also appeal to those supporters in the public who also vote Liberal in every election but who've never joined the party. We need you as members too in this important cause. And to my dear friends on the state executive, democratic reform is coming, so why not get on the right side of history? My suspension was a silly idea that has backfired. Without it, I wouldn't be speaking at the Sydney Institute tonight. So thank you very much, Mr. Downey and the executive. Suspension was never going to silence the democratic reform movement. It has, in fact, strengthened it. And finally, I too can quote Julius Caesar. We have crossed the Rubicon. Fundamental democratic reform within months is the only acceptable outcome. This debate is already 30 years old. You can't trick us with a party reform committee that's stacked with lobbyists. If you call off my suspension and invite back the others you have suspended, I pledge to work with you constructively towards building the gold standard political party structure in Australia. Thank you very much.
I'd had a night like this before in 24 years, so I'll just suspend excitement for a minute to make a few announcements. So first, thanks to the National Australia Bank for the use of this facility. It's a great facility, and thanks for that. And so we come to question discussion. There are a lot of people here. A lot of people hold strong views, and not everyone holds the same view. So if everyone can be fairly brief with their comments or their question, and we'll finish just on the top of the hour. So, John, if you just come back here, I'll lead off. I'm delighted you came along tonight. It's been a lively night. But why did you take your campaign out in public when you could have done it more? You could also have done it in private, as you had been doing for a while. And secondly, why is it you? I mean, in New South Wales over recent years, we've had three of the most successful Liberals in the party's history, John Howard, Tony Abbott, Barry O'Farrell. What's the former leadership and the current leadership saying on these kind of issues?
Just come back. Okay, well, yes, this campaign has I'm openly speaking to the media, and it wasn't our intention. What simply happened was Tony Abbott, at his very first cabinet meeting, passed a law or did something where he said that lobbyists shall no longer be able to serve on the executives of political parties. Now, when Walter and I ran for president and vice president of the party last November, that was one of our campaign themes. Yeah, that was like, yeah, that was like, yeah, we had like, yeah, a few points, and that was like, right, we had hammered that point, no lobbyists on the state executive. So we decided to send out an email after Tony Abbott had brought in this reform. And we said very clearly at the top of that email that it's not our intention to email people outside of state executive elections, which is not due for another 12 months. And then the next day, the 7:30 report from ABC rang me up and they said, would you like to elaborate about that on air? And I thought, well, you might get me kicked out of the party. And then he said, look, well, we'll make sure that we don't say any, we'll just talk generally about Tony Abbott's policy. I said, okay, I'll come on in. So then I only spoke for 10 seconds. If you read the text of what I actually said, they were nuts to suspend me for it. I said nothing. Ross Cameron's at the back of the room. He should have got 50 years. So then I really didn't think that they were going to suspend me over it. But then, you know, they have a study executive meeting and they suspend. So then I said, okay, if you want a war, I'll give you a war. And so, you know, they started it and I think, I used the term in the speech that the party's been hijacked. We can continue to fight in the party but it's, unless the public knows about it and the media knows about it, this is a fight that could go on for decades. It has been going on for decades, and the system's getting worse. What happens is we have a state executive that if a branch comes along and says, oh, we really like democratic reform, well then, you know, within a few months, surprise, surprise, oh, the branch is now considered to be unconstitutional. And we'll say, oh, why was it unconstitutional? And then they just say, oh, it just is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Or if there's a branch, they just, like, almost every day, when I said they're increasing, acting increasingly erratic, almost every day I hear someone from across New South Wales say, John, you're not going to believe what happened to our branch. Okay, now, it's, if you get up and say you support democracy, then they take away the powers in the branch. So, look, this is, you know, well, we're going to put out a website. We've gone rogue, and we're going to win. And now, on the question about John Howard and Tony Abbott. Okay. I had been very active in the party in the 1990s. Yes, I had been active in the factional war. And look, if you're going to tear down the factional system, the best person to do is someone who's been on the inside. I got to about the year 2000 and I just thought to myself, look, I thought we were the good guys and we were trying to replace the bad guys. And I just thought one day, look, we're probably all the bad guys. And, so then I didn't attend a branch meeting for 10 years. Now then I was distressed about reading about branch stacking and rigged pre-selections for 10, it was getting worse. After I'd left, things had got worse and worse. So then I thought, look, someone's got to run for president on a bold democratisation agenda. But since I hadn't been in the party for a long time, I thought, well, it can't be me. I'd encouraged other people to run for party president, but no one would. So I then at Christmas time 2010, I was reading John Howard's Lazarus Rising. On the second last page, he gave a beautiful paragraph on why we need to embrace plebiscites. And I just said, okay, look, I'm sick of thinking this is the right thing to do. I'm just going to have to do it myself. And so John Howard, and when I ran for president in 2011, I was running against John Howard's former chief of staff, Arthur Sinodinos. So you would think that John Howard would have been, wouldn't have supported me in any way. Now, he didn't ring me up or email me or anything, but he gave about three or four media interviews during that campaign, not mentioning me by name, but endorsing my agenda, which was that we need to have a statewide plebiscite for the Senate and the state executive as well, which was tremendously encouraging. So, and then last year at State Council, when we had a vote, and when the state executive, or when the State Council voted 60% to not have plebiscites, Tony Abbott was meeting Prince Charles that day in Canberra. He was not expected to turn up to State Council. But he did turn up as the Leader of the Opposition. He walked into the biggest blue of all time, and he got up there and he said, in the most emphatic way, I support plebiscites in the New South Wales Liberal Party and I support them coming in quickly. And it couldn't have been better. Now, on Barry, well, he said at the same meeting, he said, I support plebiscites, I always have. But I'll stop there because that's all I could say on that point.
John, just stay where you are. It's got to be brief. Okay.
Thank you. My name's Kerry Huxley. I ran for state executive about 4 or 5 years ago. I was told the night before the nominations closed that they had already decided who was going to be on state executive. And would I please withdraw my nomination? I said no, because I believed I had a lot to contribute. I won't go into that. But the factions got together, left and right, and told all kinds of scurrilous lies about me. I'd offered to pay for the election. Anyway, I was beaten, obviously. I was then told by a deputy state director, it is relevant, that it was great that I did it because they now know only 15% of the party is non-factionalised.
Right.
So that's pretty sad. However, my question to you is, and my deep concern is, how can you change it from the outside while we have a reform committee chosen by the factions and I don't like to use the word stacked, but there is an elephant in this room, and it's all about numbers.
Okay.
How are they going to come up with that from the inside out?
Kerry, I sympathise with you. Thank you for nominating before, and thank you for going forward with your nomination when they told you not to. But Kerry has raised a very interesting point. Because of all this pressure that has about the plebiscite and the democratic reform, that the state executive has set up a party reform committee. Now, it's dominated by lobbyists, and it's at least 80% of the people on that committee are people who have a track record of being opposed to the democratisation of the party. They have a track record of being up to their necks in factional activity. They've got a track record of centralising power at every opportunity that they can, and now they expect us to fall for this trick that they're going to bring in party reform. But it's going to be reform which is, it's designed to just drag on and on and on, way past the state election. It's designed to, they're thinking that we're stupid. So what's going to happen with that party reform committee is very simple. We're just going to ignore it. We're going to have our own, we're going to put our whole new constitution together, and if we come up with a constitution and they want to endorse it, well, that's terrific, but I don't expect that that's going to happen.
Okay, there's a question there. Yeah.
John, Tim James, well spoken. I just want to understand, in as much as anyone can, how John Howard, one of the greatest Liberals ever, certainly the greatest of his generation, can be knocked back because he's offered to be a part of this reform process. He's on the public record. He said, I will assist if there is a committee, a review, some process for me, John Howard, to assist party reform. I put my hand up. How do you think this party president and state executive can knock back that offer from a great man like John Howard?
Well, look, that's a great question, Tim. Without any doubt, not just that he's from New South Wales, obviously the greatest living Liberal is John Howard, and in fact, look, I would say since Menzies, he's probably, in the history of our party, he's number two. He's certainly the second longest serving Prime Minister of any party in Australian history. So, now, what Tim is referring to is that about a year and a half ago, John Howard gave an interview to the Australian newspaper with Imre Selezinski, and he said, if there is a party reform committee put together to talk about the introduction of plebiscites and a democratised party, I'm hereby publicly saying, it wasn't a rumour, publicly saying to the paper, I would like to serve on the committee. Now, they've put the committee together now, and John Howard wasn't invited to be on it. Now this goes back to what I said in my speech, that they are under pressure and they are behaving erratically. They should have put John Howard on it. And they still could have had all their mates on there, but if they'd put Johnny Howard on it, well, it would have given them a little bit of credibility, but no, they couldn't even think to do that.
OK, John, just stay here. We've got to be quick. Up the back and then over here. Yep.
John, it seems to me as a complete outsider that as with the Labor Party, the only way you're really going to have any hope of succeeding is if you get someone like John Howard and Tony Abbott to push it forward. I mean, that's what happened in the Labor Party. You have to do it with a leader at the top. I mean, right at the very beginning of the Liberal Party, the worst division in the whole of Australia was the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party. It took 4 or 5 years just to work it out. It's all come back, and somehow or other it won't happen unless a Menzies or a Howard, and Menzies is gone, so try Howard, gets up and leads the lot.
Okay.
That's a good
Why
point.
Why don't you enlist them?
Oh, well.
No, I mean, seriously, not just for the sake of being ourselves and feel wherever, literally go out.
Okay.
Party reform all around the world usually happens, as you say, by parliamentary leaders pushing it, and also it usually happens when a party has been in government and has lost government, when they have a time of introspection. Now, yes, we're doing this in an unconventional manner. This started... Look, 2 years ago, most people in the Liberal Party did not even know what a plebiscite was. Okay, I had spent a couple of years investigating this all around the world, saying what works, what doesn't work. So I just sort of took it on as a... I said, look, if it's going to be, it's up to me. So I started it, and when I first ran for president, I got 9% support of state council. But what's happened now is... Because it's that old saying, there's nothing better than an idea whose time has come or something. Nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. So it's an easy message to sell. I'm out there saying, hi, I'm John Ruddock, I'm not very important in the party, but guess what? I think every member of the party should have a vote. Well, it's a very, very popular message and it's gaining strength every day. Now, I believe Tony Abbott and John Howard have been constructively helping us. I believe we couldn't have asked for better help. So
there's a question here.
Going to be brief.
Sure.
If I can.
John, the one thing that one of the things you pointed to was the John, I think it is. The disgusting, unscrupulous way that they've used special powers to achieve a lot. How will your blueprint for the Constitution deal with that?
I think that any political party needs to have an executive, and the executive does need to have a bit of power. Now, our executive under our model is going to be elected by 10,000 people. It's going to be a high quality executive. It's not going to be a factional executive. But they will not have absolute special powers. There will be, it'll be very, very codified. It'll be in very, very limited cases. I would expect under this structure, special powers would be used once a decade for the type of thing I mentioned, an ill candidate during a campaign. That's what
Michael Baum.
Michael Baum. John, welcome to the club of those people who have received show cause why you shouldn't be suspended. Why on earth do you accept the proposition of the state director in his... the state president, that state council decided not to support a motion calling for plebiscites, when in fact that motion, as you well know, was a deeply flawed one that had emerged from a legal confrontation, which in fact totally influenced the vote. I mean, I'm just concerned that you're giving an impression that 60% of people at that state council meeting were opposed to the principle of plebiscites.
Yeah.
And that definitely was not demonstrated.
No, it was actually
true. I agree, Michael, that there was a difficult lead-up to that vote. Okay. And it had been through the courts, it had been appealed and everything. Now, I had nothing to do with that. I was happy that it was all happening, but I had nothing to do with it. Now, I think that those people that voted against it, Michael, I have great respect for you. I think I'll just have to disagree. I think those people were going to vote against plebiscites no matter what, regardless of what the history was, because they had been told to by factions. And now what will happen is, now they hit behind the excuse that the motions weren't thorough enough or something. Well, our next time they get a choice, it's going to be thorough enough because we're going to give them a whole new constitution.
Question, but it's got to be brief, okay?
Just quickly, John, will there be any qualifying period on new members when they join a party to be able to participate in plebiscites?
Okay, well, this is one of the things. When Walter and I sent out the blueprint, we want your feedback on these issues, but I've spoken to a lot of people about it. I believe the answer is 12 months and one day, which means that you have to pay two membership fees. If we extend it, now I think our opponents in the party are going to say you've got to be a member for 3 years because they don't like new members. We obviously can't have it so you vote immediately. I think the answer is 12 months and one day. Another quick thing, we need to make it so a member's membership doesn't expire on the financial year because it gets rorted so much. If you join the Liberal Party on the 24th of October, you pay your membership on the 24th of October, and it should be a direct debit so people don't forget to pay it, and people get knocked out all the time from this very dodgy system. But that's what I'm here keen to hear other people's thoughts.
And attendance at branch meetings.
No, I can't take everyone. There's a question here.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to be very brief.
Okay. To break the power of lobbyists, all we need is the Cabinet to obey the code of conduct of lobbying and ban a government relationship officers and industry lobbyists from being state executive.
Here.
This would then help us achieve your goals. What do you think?
I'm with you 100%. Caroline's point is that registered lobbyists are now banned from serving on the executive political parties, but it obviously needs to include lobbyists who are in-house. If you've got a job and a decent proportion of your responsibility is to influence lawmakers, that's fine, but we don't want you serving on a political party executive. Now, what's happened at the moment is we've had a couple of lobbyists to leave, just two, our state executive, but there's at least another half a dozen who should not be there because their job is to influence lawmakers.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. As it was.
Speech will be emailed out before midnight tonight.
I'm Walter Tite.
Well, you've got to be brief, and here's the mic.
No, there you go.
I'm the first Liberal member for Wagga Wagga. I'm succeeded by Joe Shipp, the second Liberal member for Wagga Wagga, and now by Darryl Maguire. The recent calling for nominations for the Wagga seat was not published in any shape or form in Wagga Wagga.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Darryl Maguire's company 5 days before nominations closed. He didn't mention it to me. Joe Shipp and I have made a joint statement to the Wagga Press. I'm waiting for my expulsion notice. I joined the Liberal Party and I've been financial ever since, as the 1st of January 1948.
I have been following what's happening in Wagga Wagga. I had a phone call today about it. It is a disgraceful rot. I mean, when I went on the Separate Affairs Report the second time, I said, if they said, throw me out of the party, I'll have a rot a week. I can have a rot a day. And that is, what is happening in Wagga is not good. And thank you for speaking up, and there needs to be more attention on it.
I think here's the last question. There's one there and there's one here. See how we go. We've got to be quick. Yep.
I was interested in Gerard's comment of why you've taken this outside, and I think it's systematic closing down the internal debate in the party.
Yes.
It's been something the state executive has been predominant in. There's an underlying public principle here. For years, the Liberal Party have preached to corporations, not-for-profit organisations, to everybody who has public funding, charitable, that they have transparency and accountability, and that they conform to government's guidelines. It seems that the only exception to this, as a result of both the Liberal and the Labor Party federally and at state levels, is that none of those rules apply to us. As a member, I have never seen a full accounting of the finances of the party. They've each year been flashed on a screen and pulled down because you don't want the other party to know what it is. And the accountability that you talk about with lobbyists pervades the party to all its offices.
Well, look, I am not a lawyer. I dropped out of law school. But but I understand that the other divisions of the Liberal Party come under the corporations law to some extent, and the New South Wales Liberal Party is still constituted as something like a club or an association from the 1940s, which means that there's really not much... There's no accountability. There's no corporate governance, as you say, and we desperately need it, no question about it.
There's a question there and over here. Got to be very brief, yes? You want to go? Yes?
Yes. How can we get a copy of tonight's speech?
Well, I've got a database of almost 10,000 members. So if you're not on that database, I'd love you to help me to get to 10,000. So give me your email. I'll be emailing out to people tonight.
Okay, final question. Yep.
Bruce McDonald, congratulations on your address, John.
Thank you.
And fortunately, thankfully, you won't be having to go to a meeting on Friday night. But the State Council meets on Saturday.
Yes.
It's a very bland agenda. Is there any intention for anybody to move suspension of standing orders? I'm not a delegate, I'm only going there as an observer, to debate or consider questions of either the Committee of Reform or to suspend even the pre-selection notices that have gone out or anything that can reflect that. I mean, we can't afford to not miss at that meeting, at least the issues of which you've discussed tonight, at least being brought forward. So the mechanics of that are not provided for in the agenda. Have you thought about that?
Okay. Just have a quick reply. Yeah.
For people that don't know, Bruce is the former leader of the opposition in New South Wales. He was the first person I ever met in the Liberal Party in 1992. Now, Bruce, in answer to your question, it's a really good question. So what I propose we do is go across the road to the establishment and talk about it, because I've been thinking about this speech and nothing else for the last week. Let's talk about state council tactics over a beer now.
Okay.
Thank you. I think we all probably need a beer or a holy water or something like that. Look, I didn't know that the council was going to be on Saturday when it was suggested to us that John Ruddock should speak here. Anne and I thought it was a good idea, and we're not involved in these deliberations, but it's been a very lively night, I have to say. Full of passion, and anyone who wanted to have a say, I think I caught everyone who had their hand up. So I was pleased to do that. Thanks for your paper. I think it'll have an impact.
by about 7:30 tonight. Send out 10,000 emails. Anne's probably a bit upset because she sends out 10,000 emails a day, so she'll have to up that tomorrow, I think. So, look, many thanks, John, for a fine presentation, important talk, and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.